We're going to do a sort of marathon run here today because I had planned 10 lectures when I came thinking I would have 5 each week, and then for a variety of reasons it was cut down to 9. So in the fall of 1944, which is the year that I turned 6 years old, my father became ill, and he was too ill, in fact, to take my mother to the hospital when she was about to give birth to my youngest brother. He was too ill to take care of us children at home. He was too ill to go and pick her up and bring her back home. He didn't get better. In fact, he kept getting worse. Soon the diagnosis came. It was cancer. I prayed with all of the assurance of a child who deeply believed in a loving God and a God who could heal, that he would get well. And I also prayed with all the fervor of a child who knew she couldn't live without that wonderful and gentle presence in her life. Before the first flowers of spring had blossomed, he was dead, and I watched as his body was lowered into the ground. "We need to accept this," I heard weeping adults say. "It must be God's will. God's ways are not our ways. The Lord will provide." In my child's mind, God's will became synonymous with deprivation and suffering. God was a tyrant who took and left little in its place that I could see. About 10 years ago, I volunteered to lead a 12-step meeting, an Al-Anon meeting, on the 11th step. And I didn't know what the 11th step was at the time I volunteered, or I never would have done it. The 11th step reads, "We seek through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as understood by us, praying only for knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry that out." God's will and the power to carry it out, I absolutely blocked when I was trying to prepare for this meeting. All I could think about to say that would be helpful, well, I couldn't think of anything to say that would be helpful. All I could think to say was, "You better be careful. God's will can get you in a lot of trouble." I told a friend of mine in AA that I was having a real block on this step, and he said with just great surprise, "The 11th step? Why, that's the great God is for you step. That's the great God is for you step." And I thought, God is for me? I thought about my life, about all that had happened, about the fact that our son had become an addict. And while he was in recovery at that time, it was a very shaky recovery. I thought about the effects of his addiction, the effects that it had on the rest of our family, how distorted the growing up years of our other children had become, the problems that it had caused for our marriage, how it all felt so unjust, so unfair, just like the death of my father. God is for me. As the old saying goes, with friends like that, who needs enemies? Every once in a while, an experience comes along that serves as a kind of benchmark, a way of measuring yourself and seeing how you've changed and grown. And that kind of experience happened for me a couple of months ago. That son, our oldest son, the recovering addict, is now a very warm and loving and strong Lutheran pastor who has a beautiful baby son of his own, who is our only grandchild. One day we got a frantic call from his wife. The child was having some strange seizure-like movements. They had taken him in, and the doctor had immediately given him an EEG, and it showed signs of abnormal brain waves. They were taking him to the hospital the next day for a whole raft of tests. I had no idea what such symptoms might mean, and so I called a friend of mine who was a doctor, told him what the way they had described this, and told him about the EEG. And he said that it would mean anything from something that the child would outgrow to something that could lead to very severe and profound retardation and even death. I felt absolutely ill. I sat down and I began praying that God would not let this happen. Not the worst possibilities, not to our beautiful little grandchild, not to our son and daughter-in-law. More than anything in the world, I didn't want them to have to go through the pain of raising a defective child. And then I stopped. I thought about the intensity with which my mother and other family and friends had prayed that our son would straighten up when he started going bad in junior high. I thought about all of my rantings and ravings to God to rescue us, to save us from this pain and this public humiliation and the horror of having an addicted son. And I realized that now, this many years after the fact, there is no one in our family who doesn't look back on that experience and those years as having been 100% good for all of us. We were all pushed into a humbling self-examination that produced a kind of growth and awareness that might never have happened had it not been for that pain. God didn't give my father cancer. God didn't lead our son into addiction. And God hadn't deliberately created a baby with something wrong with its brain. But in the midst of those experiences, God was for us. God was for our health, for our well-being, pushing us and nudging us, shoving us toward health, connecting us with people who would speak to us on God's behalf. The test results came back and they ruled out the worst possibilities. And so we all breathed a deep sigh of relief, and we're not sure yet exactly what causes these things. But our son and the baby and his wife were in our home in June for a time, and I was telling Pear about this time that I had gone through and how I had let go of that horrible fear for them. And he kind of laughed and he said he had gone through exactly the same process. That his first reaction was just absolute anguish and pain and horror and fear and dread of what might be ahead. And then he had thought back to his own life and about how all of the negative things that had happened had finally turned toward good. And he knew that God would take them through this one also. And as he sat in that hospital, a great serenity had come over him, and he had felt a sort of relaxing that he didn't know was possible in relationship to this child that he absolutely adores. I want to take some time to walk us through the wording of the 11th step, which for me gets more and more profound the longer I work with it and think about it. It begins with the words, we seek, we seek. Jesus said to us, seek and you will find, knock and it shall be opened unto you. Our tendency, I think, in hearing those verses has always been to put the emphasis on the result, on the finding and the opening. But I don't think that was Jesus' intent. The finding and the opening are, after all, God's business. That's God's job to do. Our task is to seek and to knock. And this knocking and this seeking lasts as long as we live. It suggests a life lived as quest, a life moving and growing and searching, a life less concerned with answers than with questions, less concerned with truth than with relationship. And you notice it says we seek. It doesn't say I seek. We're not in this alone. We seek together, helping each other and learning from each other. There is always that sense of community. The next phrase is through prayer and meditation. And there are lots of different ways of defining prayer and meditation. But one of the images that makes sense to me in thinking about what they are and what the differences between the two are, I'm back to our old house metaphor again. And when we first moved to Iowa City, the water pressure in our house was absolutely terrible. We would stand and turn on the faucet and wait for 5 minutes while it would fill to get a glass of water. And taking a shower was just sort of like dancing around under there, trying to catch the drips as they came out of the shower head. And in our usual sort of way that we have of not really noticing or taking care of upkeep of things around us, we let it go for an embarrassingly long time before we started to ask the question, do we really need to be living like this? You know, do we really need to have a house that doesn't have any water pressure? And we started looking around, and we discovered that three of the faucets were dripping badly all the time. And that usually, because of they were so hard to turn off, there was another faucet or two that was left running by a child's hand that couldn't quite get it shut all the way off. Our water pressure was so low because it was being drained all over the house by dripping faucets. I thought about my life in general and my prayer life in particular, and how all my worries and fears and anxieties are like dripping faucets, keeping me from ever having enough energy or power to live boldly and lovingly in the day. There's all these different worries. Right now, the worries about our daughter and whether she's chosen the right mate, and worries about money, and worries about this, and worries about that. And so I think of prayer as that time when I sit down and in quietness walk through my mental house and ask God to shut off those faucets. Now, in the old days, what I would have been asking God for was to fix the problem so I wouldn't have to be worried about it, you see. To change everything out there so that I didn't need to be concerned. But now what I ask God for is to fix me, to shut off the anxiety, to turn off the worry, to close down the fear. And after this prayer, I'm ready to meditate, to sit in quietness and emptiness, and to let the power and energy of God rush through. In our Shalom groups, we introduce the people to what's called centering prayer, and I don't know if any of you have heard about that. It's a name that's been given now for a way of praying that is really ancient. But it's using a sacred word to bring you into that kind of quietness and peacefulness in within, where you can feel the presence of God in your life. It doesn't always work for me. I sometimes can't stop my mind from spinning. You know, greater or lesser success with it. But it's a good goal. It's a good way of thinking about meditation. That sitting and using prayer to get all of these dripping faucets shut off, and then just sitting in quietness and letting that energy flow into and through you. Martin Luther apparently said that every Christian should spend an hour each day in prayer and meditation. And on those days when you're particularly busy and you know that you're never going to get everything done that you need to get done, then you spend 2 hours. You know, I don't know that I've ever quite gotten even to an hour. And when we talk about centering prayer, we try to encourage people to at least take 20 minutes. But just that time during the day when you sit and focus yourself at the beginning of the day, it's especially good, and certainly at the end of the day as a kind of closure. And let God's power flow into and through you. The next phrase is to improve our conscious contact with God. How God works in our subconscious, we will never know, but I suspect that God is always at work there, trying to bring healing to that whole mass of repressed memories and fears and whatever all we've got in there. But this step tells us that the purpose of prayer and meditation is to improve our conscious contact with God, a contact that we are aware of and can therefore base some action upon. I think of those of us on a spiritual journey as a part of a huge network. And I think that what God is best at doing and what God needs to do to keep the kingdom of God on earth alive and growing is to keep that network in motion. Keep that network in motion. And how does God do that? Well, I'm sure there are all kinds of ways. I can't even begin to think of all of the possibilities. But I know in my life that when I'm open, what happens when I'm not flying around and fixing the world and trying to do all these things, but when I'm open, a thought will come. Call Christy. Or, that's a long distance call to Norway, by the way. And occasionally, God tells me, call Christy. Stop and visit Vivian. You know, connect with one of the children. I get a sense that I should do something, and that comes to me. And not always, but very often when I do it, when I act upon it, it's just like, I can't believe you called. I can't believe you called. I was just thinking about you. I was just in some particular trouble. And I know things like this have happened to all of you. Maybe you've been on the giving end, and maybe you've been on the receiving end of it. Sometime on a terribly low day, out of the clear blue sky, a letter will come or a call will come. These are maybe coincidences, but I think not. I think these are God incidences. And the more I live and the more I see what's going on, the more aware I am of the movement of this network of people who are on a spiritual journey, and they connect and they touch and they bring powerful Godness into our worlds. I want to tell you one story. Before Hazelden would publish the book When a Bough Breaks, they needed to be sure that it reflected all of their current philosophies of treatment. So I had to go up there and live through their family program for a week. And so I did that, and of course you can't be in that setting and hearing all of these stories and being exposed to all of this kind of information without becoming very caught up in your own stuff. And I was supposed to be the writer, and I was supposed to be objective, and I was supposed to be all these things, but of course I couldn't be. And I ended up deeply embroiled in my own concerns and pain. And I was very much into myself, and the week ended, and the Hazelden is about 45 minutes from the Minneapolis-St. Paul airport, and they run a shuttle back and forth. And it was in the evening, and we got in the car, and there was a woman in the front seat and the driver and myself. And I was sitting alone in the back seat, and I wanted to stay that way. I wanted to stay alone. And so I just sat there and didn't speak to anybody. I was just deeply involved in my own thoughts.
What was that?
What?
Your last phrase.
Oh, I deeply involved. I was just deeply involved in my own thoughts. Yeah, my own feelings. But I was listening finally to the two of them talking. And it turned out that the woman in the front seat was a cabaret singer from Paris. And her mother lived in Vermont. And she had just flown into Vermont. All of the children had met. They had done an intervention with her mother, and then she had flown with her mother to St. Paul, brought her to Hazelden, got her checked into the treatment center, and stayed with her for a day, and now she was on her way back to Paris. And as she was talking to the man in the front, she kept using the term angel. And finally, I was just too curious, you know, and I said, why are you using that word, angel? And she said, you mean you haven't heard that term? And I said, no. And she said, oh, I thought that was common. She said, in the AA circles of which we were connected when we got to Vermont and we called, the term is used for those people that somehow come into your life, touch it in a very powerful and dramatic way, and then you probably never see them again. And I just mused on that. Angel means messenger of God. And we're going to be hearing a lecture later on today about angels and all the different ways that we can think about angels. But if you think of an angel as a messenger of God, you know that all through your life, there have been people who have come in and have spoken a word or given you a hug or touched you in some way. And they have been angels. They have spoken God's word to you. So we started talking a little bit, and we got to the airport, and we both had about an hour to kill before our planes were going to go. And so we went up to the bar, which was the best and most quiet place to talk, and we each ordered a Diet Coke. And we sat there, and we talked in a way that you sometimes talk to a stranger that you never would even talk to your best friend. We just poured out our hearts to each other. And after that hour of a kind of sharing and intimacy that I can't even remember what was spoken, all I remember was the feeling of it. We got up and we stood on the concourse and we hugged each other. She had taken her name and her address and written it on a sheet of paper and tucked it into my pocket. But we knew we'd never see each other again. We knew that. And we hugged each other and she whispered in my ear, "Two angels in the night. Two angels in the night." And then she wrapped her cape around her and walked on to her plane. And I think about that so often as I think about God's activity and work in our lives and the way that we connect and the way that we touch each other and the way that we can do that when we are open to those nudges and those little pushes and those shoves that come to us when we're open to God in our life. The next phrase of the 11th step is, as understood by us. It implies that our understanding of God is never complete. No one has truth in his or her back pocket. No one has a clear image of the divinity. All of us are seeing as in a mirror dimly. But it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. Whatever our understanding is, whatever our image is, God is able to work with us and in us and through us to bring healing to a broken world. All we need is to be open to an ever-expanding and deepening understanding of our Creator. The final phrase is, praying only for knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry that out. I was always very frustrated by that word only. Why should we be able to pray only for that? And in fact, I think through some Freudian slip, when I typed up the 12 steps that are listed in this meditation book, that word is omitted. So if I ever do another run on it, I'll have to put it back in. Why can't we pray for our family and friends? Why can't we pray for the world? Why can't we pray for the poor and the starving? Why can't we do all of those kinds of things? I think finally we can and we should. But while we're struggling to recover from all that has bound us in the past, it's very dangerous to pray for others. And the reason it's dangerous is because we slide so quickly into thinking of God as our errand boy or girl, whom we send out to fix everyone around us in the way that we want them fixed. You see, in the way that we want them fixed. When my husband had the call to Iowa City, it had barely come in the mail, and I was packing. I wanted to move to Iowa City so badly, I just knew that was the place we were supposed to go. After all, that's where the writer's workshop was. That was my place, you see. And I was praying every morning, oh God, help him accept this call, help him accept this call, help him accept this call. for me. I don't care about the church, for me. I want to go to Iowa City. And finally I stopped, and I called a friend of mine, and I said, would you pray for us? Would you pray for his wisdom in this call? My vested interest is way too strong. I can't pray. I cannot pray objectively about this because I want it too much. And I don't know what's best for me. I don't know what's best for him, for the family, for the church there, for the church in Morris that we would be leaving. I really didn't know, but I thought I did. And I couldn't pray objectively.
She didn't unpack her bags, though.
Oh, no. Well, you always gotta, you know. Be prepared, exactly. It's very hard not to think that we know what's best for our families, for other people. it's most hard of all to not to think we know what's best for ourselves. And so it's very hard for me not to pray for inspiration. I always go into this absolute fear between books that I will never write again. You know, that I'm empty, that I'm used up, that words will never come again. It's a very frightening thing. And so it would be very easy for me to pray for a project, pray for inspiration, pray for all these kinds of things. After all, wouldn't that be God's will for me? Wouldn't these things be God's will for me? But of course, if they are, then why do I have to pray for them? All I really need to pray for is to be open to God's will. That's all I really need to pray for. And that will come. If I really trust my Creator, if I really trust God, then I just need to be open. The wonderful thing about the 11th step is that it again uses the word power. And those of you who have been in on most of these sessions know that when we begin the 12-step journey, we talk about powerlessness. And it's a very, very difficult thing for people to deal with a sense of powerlessness. But the purpose of the 12 steps and of the Christian journey, of course, is not to leave us powerless. It's to leave us powerful, but empowered with God's energy and not our own, and empowered for God's will for our life and not our own will for our life. So we return to a prayer for power, and that power can come to us now that we have learned how to use it in the right ways and in the right direction. I want to share a couple of verses about the will of God that I found in the 4th chapter of John. These verses come right after the wonderful story of Jesus sitting by the well of Jacob and telling a Samaritan woman more things about himself than he'd even told his disciples. The disciples were, of course, dumbfounded that he was talking to a woman, and even more dumbfounded that her evangelism attempts were so successful. I mean, she went back to the village and came back with all these people who then believed. And they were really frustrated about the whole thing. They also thought that Jesus must be very hungry, and so they, when they couldn't convince him that he shouldn't be doing all these stupid things like talking to Samaritan women, they said, well, why don't you at least eat something? He declined the food, and he said, my food is to obey the will of the one who sent me and to finish the work that God gave me to do. My food is to obey the will of the one who sent me and to finish the work God gave me to do. To say that doing the will of God is like food is to say that such action nourishes us, that it restores us, that it energizes us, that it helps us grow, that it gives to our spirits what food gives to our body. The will of God is that we live as people created in God's image, our work energized by love and love manifested in our work. And all of the choices that we make along the way that feed our spirits are God's will for us. Every choice that we make along the way that feeds us, feeds our spirits, is God's will for us. So we're back to the beginning. Is God really for me? Can I believe that? Can I live and pray with the confidence that what God wants for me is all that would make my life better, more free, more open, more confident, more loving, more joyous, more productive, more peaceful? Can I walk through the darkness without being afraid, knowing that God is with me and able to use even darkness to work for me? Do I really believe that everything I do to help myself be stronger and healthier and more competent is God's will for me? And the 12-step answer to that is, yes, this is the way that we can live, and this is the way that we can walk. So that's the 11th step. Are there any questions about that or comments? If we had time, what I would have done right now is to break you up into small groups and let you share some of the things that are blocks for you in your own prayer life. And we all have those blocks. I mean, there's all kinds of different things that block us in a meaningful prayer life. And sometimes it's helpful to talk about them and to talk about ways that we can get beyond them. So maybe in your own conversations during the day, you can focus yourself. Go on. Okay. The 12th step for those of you who can't read it is having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, or these principles for spiritual growth, which is the way that the that we have rewritten it. I missed a few words, didn't I? Got confused with the green and the brown. Okay, let me read it from here. Having experienced a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to others and to practice these principles for spiritual living in all our affairs. So there's two thrusts to this 12th step. And I'm going to talk about the second one first, because this was the thrust that has brought the 12 steps into the public arena. It was discovered by alcoholics that the 12 steps work to help them maintain sobriety in their lives. But then it was also discovered as time went on and as they lived more and more sober a life, that these same principles, these same ideas, these same notions of going from powerlessness to turning things to God, to looking at yourself, to making amends, all of these principles also apply to every other sphere of their life. Every other sphere of their life. And so they practice these principles in relationships in their families and in relationships to their bosses and their employees and in all the facets of their life. And when they did it, it worked, you see. And so it was that experience that people had that this sort of way of living was much more than simply a way to be sober. It's much more than simply a way to overcome an addiction. It's a way to live a full and free life. The notion began to move out into the public arena, and people all over the world now are taking advantage of this way of walking, which is one way, it's not the only way, certainly, but it's one way that allows people to grow and to live a more full and free and productive life. The other part of the 12th step, they're combined, of course, because as we practice these principles for living in all of our affairs, we are, in fact, carrying the message to others. But the first part of it is what's called the evangelism step. And my idea, had we had this as a whole hour, was to break you into groups and have you talk about evangelism and think back on your life on the kinds of approaches of other people that have worked for you and the kinds of approaches that haven't. You know, what is helpful in getting people to grow and what is not helpful? I had a mother who was very dear in many ways, but one of the things that she never quite was able to let go of was her need to make us Christians, in her definition. And so whenever she would come to visit, she would have all of these suggestions, and they were always very subtle, for how we could better be living, and how we could, you know, and I was not supposed to be involved in politics, and my sister was not supposed to be doing this, and they were supposed to be going to church, and she would leave Bibles lying around in various rooms. And of course, the whole thrust of that was very negative for all of us, and it just didn't work. And so the whole question of what works and what doesn't work is a very interesting one. Does it help when somebody comes up to you on the street corner and says, "Are you saved?" Well, mostly it doesn't. Mostly it's like my husband always says, he always says, "Hell yes." And goes on his way. So it's very interesting to think about what works and what doesn't work. But the reality is that when we have something, unless we give it away, we can't keep it. Unless we give it away, we can't keep it. So the image has been used often this week of ourselves as like a pool. And with the love of God and the peace of God flowing into us, unless we cut channels out, unless we let that flow out, we become stagnant and dead, and we can no longer take in. So the whole sense of evangelism, of carrying the message to others, is in fact one of the wonderful things that we do for ourselves, so that we can keep the love flowing in. It's like forgiveness. We do it for ourselves, you know. I remember when Ayn Rand's books first came out, and she based all theory of human behavior on vested self-interest, and I found that horribly upsetting. That surely there was altruism. Surely there was, the purity of a gift with for nothing in return. But the reality is that the good things that we do are good because, in fact, they're good for us. And they, in fact, work. These aren't obligations. These aren't duties. These aren't responsibilities. You know, we don't need to go around weighted by all of this sense of having to do things or not do things. Because the good ways to live are the ways that are good for us. And carrying the message to others, cutting the channels to other people, allows that wonderful flow through us and into us. But there are still many problems involved. And I was thinking about when our oldest son first came back from treatment, and he had that wonderful washed look of a newborn. You know, he had gone through an experience that just flushed out all of the pain and all the guilt and all the anger and all of that junk that had made him hard and tough and just so difficult. And he had this wonderful openness, and he had admitted his powerlessness over alcohol and other drugs, and he knew that that was a problematic area of his life. But they hadn't had time to really teach him about other facets of the 12 steps, and so he hadn't quite figured out that he also needed to admit his powerlessness over other people. So he came back, and he was absolutely convinced that he was going to be able to save his younger brother and save all of his friends and get them all into treatment and make the world a better place and undo all the damage he had done. And, you know, he was going to fix everything around him. And, of course, just he got slapped down time after time after time after time. Because, of course, he had no control over others. He was determining what was best for another person, and he was going to do it. You know, you need what I got. You need what I needed. I know it. And so, go to treatment. You know, quit using drugs. Change. Be different. And he was just hit in the face time after time. And it wasn't that his assumptions were probably wrong about those people. But his assumption that he was responsible for fixing them and that he had power to do so was wrong. And they sensed that and reacted negatively in the same way that we sense that our mother thought she had power over us to fix us and reacted negatively. So one of the most important assumptions as we begin to carry this message to others is to live with the full awareness that we have no power to change or fix another. And it's not our business to do that. It's not our business to change or to fix another person. I don't know how many of you have had experience in the world of charismatics, In our congregation in Morris, there were several people who had gone off and had a very life-changing charismatic experience. And it was real and it was true. And they came back to the congregation. And it was the same thing. They knew what everybody needed. And they took upon themselves the responsibility to tell people what was wrong with them and what they needed. And consequently, what had been a wonderful thing for them became a very divisive thing for the congregation and a very hurtful thing. I have a friend who's a leader type person in the charismatic movement. And I was mentioning this to him because it had made me very angry at the time when it happened, partly because I was one of the people that they assumed needed fixing, which of course was true, but it didn't help. You just need to be baptized in the Spirit and you wouldn't be so unhappy. And he said that his advice to people is always, after they had that kind of an experience, to wait a year. Don't tell anybody for a year. Let it mellow. You know, you need to learn, first of all, that you don't have God in your back pocket, that you don't know everything. You need to realize that you don't know what's best for another, that maybe it's this, maybe it's that. You don't know. And you need to just let it mellow for a while. You need to realize that just because you've had this experience, your life is not going to be perfect. And that you can't fix other people's lives by letting them have that experience or insisting that they have that experience. Your life is struggle, and you need to learn that before you begin to talk about what's happened to you. And that's very good advice, I think. There's a wonderful image, I think, that we need to keep in mind when we think about the ways that we begin to connect with other people. I think it's Gerald May in his book, Addiction and Grace, that says that the one thing that all human beings have in common, the only thing that all human beings have in common, is a sense of emptiness at our center core. An emptiness at our core. And I don't know how many of you have seen these children's toys, where there's these little plastic figures and they're on a rope. And they've got holes in their stomachs and they're all connected. And I think about that. I think about how that emptiness is what connects us. Not what we know, not what we think we know, not our experiences, not our salvation, not our special link to God. None of those things are what connects us to others. It's our emptiness. And whenever we think about ourselves and our relationships to others, we need to connect at that level and not with our knowledge. And that's the emptiness with which that God's love can flow through from us to another, a connecting thread. We talked in the sixth and seventh step about the defects of character that we need to ask God to remove. And I think before we can really adequately carry this message to others, there are two defects that we really need to work on before we can do that. And the first one I've been alluding to, and that's arrogance. That's the assumption that we know what's best for another person, that our experience is what another ought to have, that our knowledge is what another ought to have, that the book we've read is what will do the trick for another person. And all of that has to do with what they call in the program taking another's inventory. And it's always said that we should not take another person's inventory. We concentrate on ourselves. And of course, the only way that we can come to the conclusion that we know what's best for another person is to have figured out what's wrong with them in the first place. So, and the only way you do that is to take that person's inventory. And we need to just step back from that. It's not our business to take another person's inventory, to figure out what's wrong with them, and then to figure out how they can get fixed. And so that arrogance or uh, that that leads us into that kind of thinking is a character defect that we need to really work on before we can be free to take the message to others. And the other defect that is equally as important is the defect of a low self-image or self-esteem or self-abnegation. You know, that sense that I am not worthy. I really don't have anything important to say. I mean, yes, this has happened to me, but nobody really will be interested in that, you see. That sense of unworthiness, which is equally as damaging to us as a sense of arrogance. And so if either of those character defects are a part of our foundation, those are things we really need to work on before we begin to think about the caring of the message to others. And then I think it's very important also that, well, it's interesting that the 12th step is the 12th step. It's the last one. And so it presupposes daily meditation and prayer. It presupposes kind of a constant inventory. It presupposes all of these things that would keep us from the pitfalls of the kind of evangelism that tends to be so counterproductive. In his first devotional book, Oswald Chambers writes, "Spiritually, we cannot measure our lives by success, but only by what God pours through us, and that we cannot measure at all." The 12th step has to do with what God pours through us. We cannot even usually know, much less measure, what that is. It talks about having had a spiritual awakening, and the image is that we were asleep, that parts of us were not fully alert, fully awake, and that through this process something has happened, something has changed. We've had a spiritual awakening through the walking of the other steps. And that by doing that, we do become a channel of God's love and God's power to others. Sometimes we tell through our words, sometimes through our actions. Sometimes our telling is premeditated and conscious. Often it is unconscious and spontaneous. The hardest people to talk to are the people closest to us, of course. And they are the people that need to see the difference, not hear it. They're the people that need to see it, not hear it. So mostly what the 12th step is all about is, and I'm quoting from a sermon my daughter gave, actually, kind of weaving around. It is simply the living out of who we are. Having had a spiritual awakening, we carry the message to others simply by the living out of who we are. A life so lived becomes a life of wonderful abandon. We love ourselves with the same intensity that a mother loves a newborn. We know we have been summoned to a vocation, to a calling, to a task in this world for which we are uniquely qualified. Sometimes that vocation has to do with what we do to earn a living, but often it does not. The call is from God, who needs us to be passionately engaged with the world, working to bring healing and wholeness to all creation. Our call resonates deep within us, interweaving with our gifts and talents in a way that creatively empowers us. And this life then, so lived, we become a part of a spiritual network. Dom Helder Camara speaks about the Abrahamic minority. As maybe many of you know, he worked for years as a priest in South America, trying to change the institutional church, doing everything he could to change the institutions of the world so that they would better serve the needs of the poor. And he hit against a brick wall over and over and over again. And finally he came to the conclusion that in spite of, usually, and sometimes with the help of, the institutions, There is a network of good people all over the world who are working for the betterment of humanity. And he called that, those people, the Abrahamic minority. And it is these people of which we become a part, it is this network of which we are a part when we move on in our spiritual journeys. These are the people who know they have been blessed so they can be a blessing, who know they have been given to so that they can give. They are people on a journey to a land that God will show them, but living each day, one day at a time, as if they had arrived, as if this day were the gift. A dry drunk is a person who is not drinking, but who is not using these principles for all of their affairs, so that all of the old ways of thinking and old ways of relating to people, the manipulative, the controlling, the deceptive, the using ways of living, are the ways that they live. So in fact, they're not drinking, but they're not walking the spiritual path. Does that make sense? Yeah. And that's a very sad thing. You know, it's just taking one tiny part of what could be a wonderful life and not taking the rest. Oh, well, I don't know exactly. I just know that that word came out of Emotions Anonymous, though, you know, I don't know why it isn't generally used because it's such a good one. But I think people who suffer from these mood swings that they have so little control over need to have a very clear way of catching themselves when they're starting to swing down. And that's why they have this word that is so dramatic, halt, you see. So they can flag those feelings that they know are going to get them in trouble and then just stop and take care of themselves before they swing down. So I think that's why, you know, each of these groups, different kinds of things grow up as being helpful, and what we need to do, of course, is to look around and see what's happening in other groups and what can be brought into all of the groups. But I think that's one idea that's very useful for everybody. But it just happened to have grown up in Emotions Anonymous. Does that make sense? Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah. Well, it depends upon what the problem is, you know. But oftentimes it takes just sitting down and maybe reading some meditative material, maybe spending some time in prayer and meditation, getting yourself centered again. Because all of those things have to do with being off center, being pulled out of your center, you see. And so you stop, and then you do what you need to do to get yourself pulled back into center. You know, for me, it's usually just pulling back, taking time for myself. Sometimes it's crying. Last Sunday, I went out on a log, and I just sat and cried. I was just, for whatever reason, that's what I needed to do. And that was very helpful. You know, there's just all kinds of ways that we learn how to be good to ourselves and give ourselves what we need. I think that they work when people have truly gone through the process of letting go. I know with our son, all of the stuff that we did prior to that time didn't work. But something happened, and it happened fortunately with both of us at the same time. You know, because otherwise it's hard to get everybody in agreement at the same time on something. And it happened after his fourth arrest. And we both deeply, deeply gave up. I mean, we just gave up. And we knew it was absolutely out of our hands at that point. And when you have gone through that point, then what an intervention becomes is a way of letting God's power come to bear on the situation. But if you're on this side of that point, what an intervention is manipulation. And the person senses it. See, we had to be ready to give him up as a son. We had to be ready to shut the door and say, "You're no longer our son. There's nothing more you can do. The price is too high to pay having you in this house. And so you're out." that we had to be at that point before the intervention could work.
And how old was he?
What?
How old was he?
He was a senior in high school. Yeah. But a lot of people, you know, hear about interventions and they do them as one more way of trying to control and manipulate the other person. And then it usually doesn't work. So,
when you closed the door, did you have any opposition from him at going into treatment or being...
Well, he just took off. And
he left.
He left. And we had, I think, was it 2 or 3 days of just hell?
Yeah.
Absolute hell. And then he came back and said he wanted to go to treatment.
He did come back on his own.
Yeah.
It gets awfully cold in November in Minnesota, you see. And when you're sleeping in the car.
In your car, yeah.
You know.
He at least had a car.
He had
what
a car.
These
the,
other kids.
Yeah. And got a little cold, you know, at night. And, so we had an ally in the weather.
Yeah.
What do you do when people ask you for help? They come to you as a friend, a problem.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe they haven't had any background.
Yeah. Well, what I always say first is the best thing that you can do is to help yourself, is to grow yourself.
They've been trying. Yeah.
You know. Yeah. And you know, sometimes I share my story with them. For people to know they're not alone is usually very helpful. I know that was very helpful to me. When finally I got pulled into a network of people who were, so I didn't feel so horribly alone. This was, you know, 12, 15 years ago, and at that time you didn't hear about this as much. Good families didn't raise addicts, you know. And so it was a very, very lonely, lonely thing.
There are many resources now, too, so you don't have to feel like you're in this alone.
Yeah.
Dissuade someone that you're a messiah is very important early on.
Yeah.
And to, at the same time, express your willingness to walk.
With them,
with
yeah.
Them.
We don't have, I mean, I don't have answers for other people, you know.
That's what I wanted to know. How do you deal with that? They say, I know you've been studying this and that.
And everybody's looking for a quick fix,
yeah.
For an easy answer, for a quick solution. You know, all you can say is you just walk the path and you try to do it by getting as much help for yourself as you can. And the help for yourself is in fact the only thing that you can do to help the other. And that isn't a satisfying answer to most people, you know.
No.
But it's the only way. Yeah.
The biggest thing when somebody comes and asks for my help, let's say, the thing that I keep remembering is I tell them right off the bat, I will not take care of you.
Mm-hmm.
I care about you, but I will
we'll
not
take care
take
of you.
Care of
mm-hmm.
you.
Mm-hmm.
And one kid, he's my age, and he didn't have a place to live, trying to get sobered up, trying to get off drugs, and I slept in my van for quite a while, and I says, well, here, you can live in my van. That's where I started out, and look where I'm at today.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll probably do you some good.
Yeah.
And I says, it's yours, you can sleep in it.
Yeah.
But I won't, you know.
Won't take care of you, yeah. And that's important, yeah. When A Ball Break came out, there was just this little flurry of media attention, of course, and I was on some radio shows, and the question was always, what could you tell other parents in this situation that will help them? You know, what is the answer? Give us the answer. And these interviewers just kept probing and probing because they wanted some wonderful message that they could send out over the airwaves that would fix everybody, you know. Well, there isn't one. Except to just walk it one day at a time and to do what you can for yourself.